explorers, welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooke Fagner. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe, of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are and why we are here and what we may become if we drop the possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Did you know you have existed for many thousands of years? The thought of reincarnation escapes most people, as it did me until I read this book. Your Never-Ending Life is the first in the Universal Learning Series from Sandy Andrews. Search your higher mind, find your soulmate, and know that you are never alone in this world. The treasures of the eternities are yours, and your first step is to read the book. Click the banner for Your Never-Ending Life by Sandy Andrews at X Squared Radio and order the book today. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who was a shining one who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysm? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two of the series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com. Get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. Welcome, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. The solar wind tonight is a fairly mild 454 kilometers per second. The sun is completely blank today, no sunspots. There is no coronal hole facing Earth right now. NASA, however, will soon begin providing stereo photography of the sun. We are getting better at studying the sun, but we still don't know why sunspots come and go and what the true source of the aurora borealis is at this time. By the way, the Lyrid meteor showers were this weekend, but probably not very visible with the bright partial moon we had. With a good telescope, however, you might have been able to see a few dozen impacts on the moon as small flashes of light. And by the way, if you're looking for a good telescope, just click on the Discovery Store banner at X Squared Radio. Hey, we're sending out our newsletter this week, and we delayed it a little bit because we were waiting for something. If you haven't signed up yet, there is still time to get in on this. There are some specials in this one you won't want to miss. I have agreed to conduct my first workshop entitled The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. So if you want to attend, it's just $77 in person if you click on the ET Conference banner at X Squared Radio by Shalimar Productions. It will be 6 hours. You will never forget. We are going to reveal to you some amazing things about time, energy, and your ability to affect the future. If you ever thought you might like to finally learn how to manifest your dreams into reality, why don't you sign up and join us? But in case you can't make it to Mount Shasta for the June 9th through 11th conference, then we have a very special arrangement for you. You will be able to stream the workshop live for only $19.95. Wow, is this a wonderful age we live in or what? In case you're upset that we're not giving the workshop away for free, and believe me, $77 is about as close to free as you're going to see an all-day workshop, then please, don't send out your negative energy just yet. We are putting the funds to good use. All the proceeds from this particular workshop are going to the Phoenix Science Foundation to be used for energy and consciousness awareness activities. In the news, make sure you aren't surfing anything sensitive while you're sitting at your local Starbucks. Those public Wi-Fi networks are being sniffed by very sophisticated programs that analyze your searches and your emails. So just a heads up for you cyber-savvy folks out there with your office in a laptop. Today is Earth Day. I don't know if you need an official to declare this for you or not. If not, stay tuned to X Squared Radio and check out our archives, because we are working with the folks down at Phoenix Science Foundation to reverse man's contribution to global warming by eliminating the need for fossil fuels for combustion. If you're interested in helping, go to PhoenixScienceFoundation.org. They are adding new things every day and getting ready to launch a very strong effort to bring new energy devices to the consumer level. We don't invent them. We just try to bring them from the inventor to you. This takes money to do, and you know that governments aren't going to help. So all the progress has to come from you, the concerned earthling. So just go check it out. Last week, Marine St. Germain and I returned from Tibet with a good group of Earth explorers. Some great film was made, and we're incorporating that into the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition documentary. The first DVD was 22 minutes long, and you can still buy it at our online store at X Squared Radio. But this version will be around 45 minutes long and will include footage that no one has ever seen before. We got into places with our Tibetan guide that the general public, nor not even National Geographic, gets into. Ever wonder how the Tesla coil became one of the central icons for Tibetan Buddhism? Well, you can find out if you see this film. It will be debuted at the Science, Spirit, and Earth Transformation Conference in Hawaii next month. After that, it will be available at the online store. Hey, next week we have Walter Bosley and his intriguing study of the 33rd parallel, as well as his remarkable findings at Disneyland. So don't forget to tune in live and call in if you can. This week we have a special edition of X Squared Radio. We have with us tonight Dr. Michael Sala, who's joining us for the first hour. And then each half hour we will have a guest speaker added to him that is appearing at the upcoming Science, Spirit, and Earth Transformation Conference in Hawaii. So you get a preview tonight. If you have been wondering whether you should join us in paradise, perhaps tonight's program will convince you to book the trip. Now you have a reason to go. I promise you won't be disappointed. So listen in and see what you think. Please welcome with me Dr. Michael Sala. How are you, Michael?
Aloha, bro. Glad to be here.
Aloha yourself. I'm deep beneath the earth in western Kentucky, and I am greatly looking forward to the May conference in Hawaii.
Well, we're looking forward to you coming out of here and telling us all about your Tibet adventure and the Hollow Earth expedition.
Well, I'm looking forward to it, too. You are the head of exopolitics.org. All right, is that better? I think so. Can you hear me, Michael?
I can hear you well, Brooke.
Are you hearing an echo on your phone?
I did at the beginning. Now.
We're sorry about that, Earth Explorers. You know, sometimes we, when we're connecting halfway around the globe, sometimes we get echoes. It's a little difficult to work through, but I think we've got it solved now. Anyway, I was going to ask you about your efforts with exopolitics.
Well, yes, Brooks, exopolitics is really an exciting development. I'm finding just more people are coming to the website and inquiring about exopolitics, wanting to know what it's all about, how it differs from the traditional UFO approach. And I think people are just excited by the possibility of understanding what the political implications of all of the evidence is about extraterrestrials visiting us. And so just getting increasing numbers of people inquiring and coming to the websites and interested in the different events that we're organizing through the Exopolitics Institute as well.
Well, a lot of people don't really, I mean, we talk about UFOs, we talk about ETs, we talk about aliens visiting the Earth, but outside organized government, we really don't think much about an organized ambassadorial effort to communicate or at least represent Earth to these off-world societies. And that's what exopolitics does, right?
Well, that's right. That's one of the aspects of exopolitics. We look at not only the political implications of extraterrestrials visiting us, but also what it is that people should do in response to this. And one of the things that we try to introduce is the idea of citizen diplomacy with extraterrestrials. And so this is part of the exopolitics approach, whereby private citizens can learn about the different modes of interaction with off-world species. And so there's a lot of protocol that's associated with that. There's a lot of training people need to do if they're going to become ambassadors to these different extraterrestrial visitors that are coming to the Earth.
Right. And so I guess my question is, recently, like in the last 12 months, have there been contacts between extraterrestrial races and Earth people, and in particular exopolitics officials or participants, where this ambassadorial effort has played out?
Well, there's a number of different ways in which contact is made. Because we really have these abilities that we only are barely understanding, often contact can happen in ways that many people are simply not aware of. For example, people may have a dream, and in that dream they can have what appears to be a really pleasant or interesting interaction with extraterrestrials, and they then wake up and just proceed to dismiss it and say, oh, it was just a dream, interesting, but that's it. Well, I mean, what if the dream itself represented a form of contact? I mean, after all, the unconscious is a really important part of who we are. And if extraterrestrials are able to communicate in ways where their whole consciousness interact with humans, that means that some of the contact may happen at an unconscious level for us, even though for the extraterrestrials, they're fully conscious. But because we have a conscious-unconscious kind of divide in our psyche, that means that these unconscious contacts, we might dismiss them as dreams, but for the extraterrestrials, these are genuine contacts, and they're passing on information. And so that is something that we need to be aware of, that our dreams may be a site for contact to happen for all of us. Then there are more conscious modes of extraterrestrial contact. Of course, there is the telepathic communication. People can have voices in their head or have some kind of fully conscious telepathic rapport connection with extraterrestrials. And so that's another form in which contact can happen as well. And many people experience that. Then you can actually have the, of course, the physical interaction where you have people meeting with extraterrestrials who are walking either amongst us in our society who have infiltrated or who have integrated in modern day society, or who come off ships and they can meet people that way. I mean, it happens in both ways.
I do have people from time to time talk to me about a phenomenon which they term a download. And I have a personal experience with that, as you well know. And I don't really know how. I didn't really communicate with this. I just more or less received only. And most of the people that I talk to and that I research, whether they're mathematicians or astronomers or just ordinary people, they don't really interact with the download. They just sort of receive raw information, raw finished information. And some of it's confusing and so foreign to what we know in our mortal lives that it can be a little traumatic. What do you advise to people who receive something like a download?
Well, a download can happen in many different ways. It can happen during a person's sleep. It can happen while a person is meditating in a kind of alpha or theta state of consciousness, and of course in the kind of mystical experiences that people have. It does seem that the download is just receiving a tremendous amount of information that consciously we cannot process at that moment, and so it means that unconsciously we are absorbing this information, and then over a period of time that information bubbles up to the conscious mind, and then we make sense of it and organize it. You obviously know or have heard of the analogy. It's kind of like our mind is almost like the hard drive of a computer, where the hard drive represents the unconscious and the memory represents the conscious mind. So really, the conscious mind is really only a small part of who we are and the full information we're getting. So if someone receives a download, it's almost like the hard drive receives this new program, and then we bring it up into the memory when we've learned how to access that program, and then we start to work with it. And I think that's probably close to the way in which these downloads work, that we get them, slowly become conscious of them, and then we begin to work with that information in ways that become meaningful.
Well, that's interesting. That the and it's consistent with what I see, that the download seems to occur to the subconscious mind, And then over time, as the subconscious mind sort of leaks into the conscious mind, we tend to recall that. And maybe it's information we're going to use in our lives, maybe it prepares us for something, or maybe it's just an awareness factor, something that tells people, hey, we're not alone, you're not alone, we know you, we're familiar with you, you're welcome, you're loved. I hear, you know, all kinds of responses from people, but how widespread is this, do you think?
Well, I think it's happening across the spectrum, that many people are having all kinds of downloads into their lives, and it's really a question of how much of that they can integrate into their lives. Now, I would imagine that those who can integrate information pretty quickly into their conscious mind and make changes, that they would receive future downloads, and these downloads might be more intense, more profound, and open up many more possibilities. If people aren't able to consciously integrate whatever downloaded information they have, then they might go through life kind of feeling a sense of dissatisfaction, a sense of maybe not fulfilling their mission. And I imagine that there are many people in that position who might have received a lot of downloads but haven't been successful in integrating those into their conscious lives or making changes, because obviously, much of the information that is passed down through these downloads that might have a kind of higher dimensional or extraterrestrial source are very profound and very transformative. So if a person receives a download but proceeds to just do the things that they've been doing for years and not make any changes in their lives, where this downloaded information can express itself in ways that's meaningful, then such a person can feel very frustrated, and obviously future downloads are unlikely until they're able to integrate the ones that they've already received.
Another phenomenon that I've heard with these downloads is sometimes the download is not in English. It's in some kind of language that the person who's receiving it doesn't understand. And sometimes the download is, I'm kind of reminded a little bit of like Edgar Cayce, who was termed a sleeping prophet. He would speak in his sleep, and then his handlers would record that or write it down, and he made something like 14,000 different transcriptions. But he was tapping into something. I've also heard of people actually receiving downloads in their sleep and speaking in foreign tongues, speaking in languages that maybe don't even exist on this world. How do people integrate that kind of communication into their conscious mind?
Well, with the trans-channeling, where people like Edgar Cayce go into that altered state of consciousness, and then they receive information, and then it's relayed back to them in some way, or they read the written notes, then this is something that they can integrate after the experience has passed. Now, with those who are consciously experiencing speaking in a foreign language, I have heard of that, and I've actually witnessed it as well, and it's a very interesting phenomenon. It's something that has been happening for a long time, and I know there are many religious groups that actually have this. They believe it's the Holy Spirit, or the charisma, as they call it, speaking through people in these ancient tongues. So it's certainly something that's been known for quite some time, and it's an interesting process, because often the person speaking this foreign tongue won't understand it, and it requires someone nearby who hears it and who is able to say, well, that's an ancient form of Hebrew or something like that. And of course, if we're talking about extraplanetary languages, well, then it's something that's going to have that otherworldly energy to that.
Wow. Well, this is It's really fascinating. What training do you conduct with exopolitics.org that could help people or awaken people to the possibility that they may have actually had contact?
Well, one of the first things we try to do is give people a basic awareness of what is happening out there in terms of extraterrestrial visitation, different extraterrestrial groups with their own distinct modalities of interacting with people, because each extraterrestrial group has its own way of communicating and dealing with people. We also give people an idea of what the governments are doing behind the scenes, because this is something that is well known to governments. And so once we give people a kind of intellectual groundwork for what is happening, then they're ready for the experiences that tend to bring up a lot of emotional issues, because this is a very profound transformation that we're witnessing, because we're going from an insular culture basically believing that we are alone in the universe and there might be nothing else other than microbes out there, to a culture that's going to become very quickly, and I predict within the next decade, a galactic society. In other words, different extraterrestrial visitors and civilizations being open about their presence, their reality. And so we're going to go through a very rapid transformation. And that means that people emotionally are going to have to really work on their own core belief systems. Because I think at an intellectual level, a lot of people can be curious about extraterrestrials, and they might be tempted to read some of the material. But that's only kind of at a superficial level, which is the conscious mind. Once you start to integrate this material at a deeper level, then it brings up a lot of emotional issues. So, for example, President Jimmy Carter is well known to have been very interested in extraterrestrials and began to actually get some projects underway so he could learn about extraterrestrial visitation, because he knew he was being denied access by the CIA and other government agencies. But at a certain time, he shut down, and that was because the information challenged some of his core belief systems, because Jimmy Carter is a very traditional religious follower, practitioner. And so when he realized that some of this information challenged his core religious belief systems, he just kind of turned away from it. It was so challenging. And I think this is part of what exopolitics is trying to do, is present this information in a way that intellectually people can integrate, and then begin the more difficult task of emotionally integrating this information. And then, of course, the next step is meeting with extraterrestrials in various ways, whether it's a kind of telepathic communication to begin with, or a more physical interaction with non-human intelligences. There's a typical process that we can enter into.
You know, I'm so fascinated by this. It seems that the downloads and the contacts that I read about, that I hear about when I go to different conferences, that I hear about being a host of this radio program, the contacts are like onesies, twosies. Maybe two people here, or one person there, or five people here. When you're talking about a rapid socio-religious change, you're talking about global contact here. You're talking about an interaction on a macro scale to make that kind of change. I don't think that, even though 68% of the planet, developed or undeveloped nations, believe that UFOs exist, it doesn't mean that all of society is ready to accept the fact that we're not alone in the universe, and that there is and has been intelligent life other than humans here on this planet. So what ideas do you have, or what kind of input or information have you collected that seems to indicate that this kind of global first contact is about to happen?
Well, I think the best evidence is the many cases of people having interactions with extraterrestrials at some level. I mean, there are just so many of them, and I can just give you a few examples. Many people have had interactions with beings that are extraterrestrials who are walking amongst the population. This is one of the things that I'll be talking about at my presentation at the forthcoming Hawaii conference, where there's a lot of evidence that extraterrestrials have integrated on the planet and are adopting a policy of meeting with and communicating with as many people, as many civilians as they can, to educate them about the reality of extraterrestrial life. And these extraterrestrials who are living amongst us, what the evidence suggests is that they adopt identities that can easily be seen to be normal, or identities that don't stand out in any way. And so these extraterrestrials really fit in, and so they can then communicate with people and just give them whatever those individuals need for contact to happen, for that awareness of extraterrestrial life to occur.
Well, so, I know where my level of excitement is. I would guarantee anonymity if anybody could get one of these extraterrestrials that are walking around among us to come on this program and reach out to the listeners that we have on this program. That would definitely be a world exclusive.
I think it will definitely happen. I mean, it may already have happened with people who may call in and may have questions or may make comments. And I mean, if extraterrestrials have integrated amongst us, and I think the evidence suggests that they have, they've learned the language to the extent that they speak with the same accents and using the same colloquialisms as any normal, say, American male or female. And so you might have one of these people ringing up and just making comments and not realizing it. Now, at some point, and I think we're probably not that far away, I think what will happen is that some of these visitors will reveal themselves and make themselves available for interviews and sharing that information, because I think there has been undoubtedly a process of acclimating the population for extraterrestrial contact. And I think the governments around the world, not just in the United States, have been allowing this to go forward. I mean, they certainly, on the one hand, ridicule a lot of people who claim to have witnessed or interacted with extraterrestrials. But on the other hand, they allow this level of information to come out because they are very concerned to acclimate or prepare people for that day when disclosure does happen. And so what we're having here is both governments and extraterrestrial visitors themselves conducting various programs to get most of humanity ready for contact.
Well, that is the job, isn't it? And it is daunting, but it is also very exciting. And I think, my personal feeling is, not just from my own experience, but also my own childhood dreams, I guess you could call them, is somehow we're going to be involved in that. Somehow this community, the one that involves you and me and maybe several dozen of the other folks that we have met in the last year, who are really pouring their heart and soul into this genre without asking anything in return, the passion is there, and they're going to be involved in this effort. I guess the thing that's frustrating, not just to me, but also to a lot of my listeners, is the fact that it appears as though governments are the liaison between everything ET and us. And frankly, I myself, and I think I speak for my listeners, we don't trust them. We don't trust government. We think that if they are having some relationships, that they're not being forthright in the communication. We think that they're holding something back from us. And we also feel a little bit of resent that they don't come directly to those who are spiritually and consciously prepared for this kind of communication. They appear to be going to governments, which I don't know if you've been to Washington lately, but I think the jury is still out as to whether there is intelligent life in Washington, D.C. or not.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, we're out here, and our consciousness is reaching out to whatever or whoever is out there trying, ostensibly trying to reach us. So this global contact could very well happen at something like this conference instead of some UN meeting.
Yes, well, I agree with what you say. It's definitely a phenomenon that is proceeding in a way that is very unpredictable, and so it works on the basis of those extraterrestrials that are more in tune with the consciousness of citizens and really looking or measuring intelligence by kind of spiritual evolution and those kinds of ethical qualities, that they would more likely interact with a group of citizens who are meeting together to discuss in a sincere and transparent way the problems of the planet and come up with some solutions to it. Now, there is one thing I just wanted to mention, like what you were saying at the beginning here about the extraterrestrials interacting with governments and that we, as private citizens, aren't aware of this. This is where the exopolitical element really comes out into the open, because what we're talking about are different extraterrestrial groups here. Some extraterrestrial groups are quite happy to work with the government in terms of trading technologies and getting in return certain benefits as basing rights and maybe working with citizens who they take up into their ships for genetic experiments and so forth. There are certain extraterrestrial groups who do work at that level, and they don't seem to be all that concerned about helping the spiritual evolution of humanity, or maybe it's a kind of secondary goal. And then there are other groups of extraterrestrials who, by and large, seem to work directly with citizens and not with the governments, and these extraterrestrials appear to be much more interested in helping our spiritual evolution proceed in a very clear and accelerated way. So we are really talking about different extraterrestrial groups here, and so that's where there's a lot of exopolitical complexity that comes into this whole picture.
Well, you mentioned spiritual evolution, and I think that is the core of it. But throughout recorded history, as far back as I have studied anyway, it appears that spiritual evolution is quite often at odds with governmental control. So I see the makings for conflict here. Those races that are working with the government, and as you say, perfectly willing to trade basing rights and trade some technology for access to genetic material, and then those who are not prone to work with the government but are much more clandestine and work with the spiritually adept, it appears that there are two different agendas going on there, and that is a setup for conflict. Do you see that in the future?
Definitely. I think this is going to be one of the really difficult issues to negotiate, because what we have is a government that not only is complicit in terms of the extraterrestrials visiting us and abducting citizens and doing genetic experiments, but has also built up a massive military-industrial complex to try to arm themselves so that at one point they may be ready to take a much stronger position towards extraterrestrials that the government themselves don't trust. And then you have those in the private sector, such as ourselves, who are aware of extraterrestrial visitors, but the ones we are mostly concerned or the most aware about are the more ethical extraterrestrials who are more concerned about our spiritual evolution. And so we naturally want that information to come out into the open and to share that. And I think the conflict is going to be how the disclosure process proceeds. Are we going to have a disclosure which is going to be presenting to the general public that, yes, extraterrestrials are here, but you can't trust them because they've been doing A, B, and C, and so therefore we need a military-industrial complex with the most advanced space weapons possible in case the extraterrestrial visitors ever threaten our independence and sovereignty. So you're going to have that particular spin. And I think what we need to do is, in the private sector, is really educate ourselves as to what is happening, and so that as we move forward into the disclosure area, that we can actually have transparency and accountability, that we have government fully reveal what has been happening, what it's been doing for the last 50, 60 years, and bring about some degree of accountability, whether it's in the form of a truth commission or some kind of process where government officials come out, reveal what they've been doing, what policies they implemented and why, and then we go through a kind of a process of reconciliation, because I think many of the policies that have been implemented over the 50 years are really horrendous or really ill-conceived, and I think many in the general public are going to be genuinely shocked when they hear this, and there will need to be a process of reconciliation, and I hope it proceeds in a way where the truth comes out most fully, so that way we can interact with the extraterrestrials on an equal footing.
Well, I know myself, having been to Washington a few times, and as I said, the lack of coherent purpose in Washington never ceases to amaze me. I guess I have to ask the question, which government are we talking about? Are we talking about the elected government, or are we talking about the bureaucratic government that we see on television from time to time, like the Joint Chiefs or Pentagon officials or people that exist from White House to White House staff over decades? They almost have a dynasty, a network. Or are we talking about a cross-national rogue government that really is beholden to no voter and no taxpayer? Do you actually think that they will disclose anything meaningful?
I think that is precisely the question we need to grapple with, is who is the government here? I mean, certainly the elected political representatives, I don't think that they are the ones making the key decisions about disclosure. I mean, many of these elected officials hardly know anything about it, and in many cases know absolutely nothing about the extraterrestrial visitation. I think there's also evidence that many of those in key bureaucratic positions, even in senior positions within the military, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, even they aren't briefed on this extraterrestrial presence. So I think ultimately what we're looking at is the way in which this transnational entity operates, that is a kind of secret government that extends beyond the US and encompasses all of the major governments, how it monopolizes this information and really dictates how and when information is released about extraterrestrials. And I know that there are factions within this transnational entity, in terms of the one faction wanting to release this information more quickly and helping the rest of the humanity prepare for the truth. And there's another faction which tends to be more reactionary that wants to keep this information secret for as long as possible. So there's definitely a conflict at that deeper level. And I think what's going to happen eventually is that elected political representatives and the bureaucracy who are out of the loop are eventually going to be faced with the question of to what extent are they going to take up their responsibility of representing the citizens of their respective countries as this information comes forward. And I think that's going to be where there can be a lot of challenges and a lot of conflict as the regular government starts to exercise more authority. And because we need to go back to, say, what happened with President Kennedy. I am one of those that believe that President Kennedy was eliminated because he threatened the hold that this transnational group had over this information concerning extraterrestrials. He wanted to exercise government oversight and authority over this information, and they eliminated him from it. And I think ever since that time, elected political representatives have been cowed into submission, and I think there are many examples of that. President Clinton is one case where in 1995 it's well known that he was briefed and basically said that he would not proceed any further on this issue, even though he knew it was real, because he was frightened of the consequences. And I think what's going to happen is that sometime in the near future, we're going to have elected government representatives seriously grapple with this issue of bringing under the regular government oversight this whole layer of secret government operations and extraterrestrial projects that are conducted in secrecy with these committees that are run by appointment without any accountability whatsoever.
Well, I guess we're all hoping that the whole thing comes down around their ears. But my good friend and yours too, Alfred Lambermont Weber, who has helped draft the Peace and Space Initiative, which you and I discussed back in August, and which I guess we're still trying to get an audience with the UN General Assembly to get it orally submitted into record, which is a proclamation from the people that we petition the government to not weaponize space in the sense that we arm Earth against other races or other groups that may try to visit the Earth who, as you said earlier, might not agree with this rogue government's idea of who the good guys are as far as who's out there trying to help us or help them. And this military economic structure that has been built on our planet, which for all intents and purposes is rather indestructible as far as their ability to affect the human mind, to surveil people, to move weaponry, and to manipulate money so that literally, nations can be brought to their knees who get close to this issue. So we're dealing really here with probably the number one issue of the 21st century, and that is the reintegration of Earth into a galactic community in a peaceful manner.
I agree. I think this question of the space weapons is a vitally important one, because if we allow this secret government to continue with its plans to secretly develop and deploy advanced space weapons that have been in the past and in the future will be targeted against extraterrestrial visitors, then we can become very quickly a menace in our galactic neighborhood. We can move from being a kind of rogue isolated planet to a very dangerous planet that spreads out to try to colonize nearby worlds, and that is a very dangerous scenario. And I think this is something that we need to become aware of, the possibility that the continued development of these advanced weapon systems using extraterrestrial technology and knowledge that has been going on for the last 50, 60 years has given our militaries, or to be more precise, given those rogue military units and projects under the control of the secret government, the capability to not only shoot down extraterrestrial visitors who are visiting the Earth, but also project that military power to some of the nearby planets in our solar system. And that would be a very dangerous step forward. And so we really need to grapple with these issues, and the more people become aware of this, the better. And I think you're right that these are the most important issues that face us in the 21st century, and we need to start mobilizing and being heard and taking action, because at this very moment, as I'm sure you're aware, technologies are coming into place whereby the human mind can be manipulated by supercomputers that can be used to manipulate large numbers of people, whole societies, to think and behave in ways that can be easily manipulated. And if we don't address these issues pretty soon, we're going to find that these sophisticated mass mind control technologies are going to be deployed more and more against us, making it more likely that any sort of scenario can be dreamed up by the secret government groups to manipulate us so that we surrender more of our freedoms and we are more easily manipulated and are kept in the dark about the truth.
Well, exactly right. Excuse me. And those who doubt this, all you need to really do is listen to Dr. Nick Begich, who's probably the world's most outspoken expert on using radio waves and radio energy for mind control. I have known him for more than 10 years. We have collaborated on a couple of projects. We're good friends, and I can tell you his research is impeccable. And if you doubt it, we'll have him back on the program, and we'll talk about it again. Trust me, mind control is not something out of science fiction. The ability to put visions into someone's mind, music, thoughts, voices, for a religious person or a person who is a zealot of some kind or another, could be inspired like the Prophet Muhammad coming to speak to them in their mind. They're set up for it, they're hardwired for it, and these rogue government entities know that these individuals are out there, and they can just rile them up any time they like with this weaponry. I was going to ask the question about this projecting military power of Earth into the galaxy. We're not too good at traveling in space. We more or less sit our little butts down in a titanium can and blow some hydrogen peroxide out the back, and we move around space at, you know, a couple hundred thousand miles an hour. In order to be effective in space, it's going to take energy sources and propulsion systems far in advance of anything that we have demonstrated inside or outside our atmosphere. And probably the most frustrating thing to me about this exchange of technology between ETs and Earth-based entities is the fact that a lot of this technology is not specifically designed to be weapons. It's designed to be energy sources. And that energy, those energy sources, could very likely end our need to shovel our planet into our gas tanks and burn it. So where, you know, we're talking about not billions of dollars, maybe trillions of dollars worth of business. Why do you think that the energy prospect of this ET technology has not been shared with private industry?
Well, I think it's because that technology very early on was known to the Sikh government, that transnational grouping, and because it very seriously threatened the existing oil interests at the time, and which continue to the present day to reap massive profits that are used for projects and purposes that the most in society and elected political representatives aren't aware of, that I think that these technologies have been suppressed from the mass public and secretly developed and used for whatever weapon systems and whatever other projects the secret government has in mind. And I think that the secret government does have the capability to project its military abilities off planet. It doesn't have to be purely through the what we consider to be kind of conventional transportation devices, where they get into a spaceship that uses some advanced propulsion system. I believe that they have discovered or have developed technologies such as Stargate, such as these dimensional portals, where they can send teams through these portals to other places. And I think that's how they can deploy their military abilities, even if the Earth itself is under a quarantine. And I think this is something that we really need to look at seriously, that has the Sikh government been going around discovering throughout the planet these hidden locations where these dimensional portals or stargates, whatever we want to call them, whether these exist or knowledge of them is known, and utilize that to be able to deploy its own personnel in places that are outside or off-planet for the purpose of conquest.
Wow, that is absolutely amazing. Well, anyway, that brings us to the top of the first hour. I'm sorry we didn't get Angelica on the phone with us, but you know, she's busy, and Galactic Diplomacy is a busy company, and there's a lot going on there. This at the top of the hour, we're going to bring Ralph Ring on, right?
That's correct, yes.
Okay, so what we will do now is we will take our quick commercial break, and then we'll be back in about 6 minutes, and we will bring Ralph Ring in, and we'll give you his intro. So don't go away. Remember, this is a three-hour program, so we're doing our best here to solve all of the technical problems, but we'll get through them. Trust me, Earth Explorers, this next hour will be worth it. Don't go away. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio. You know you have existed for many thousands of years. The thought of reincarnation escapes most people, as it did me until I read this book. Your never-ending life is the first in the Universal Learning Series from Sandy Andrews. Search your higher mind, find your soulmate, and know that you are never alone in this world. The treasures of the eternities are yours, and your first step is to read the book. Click the banner for Your Never-Ending Life by Sandy Andrews at X Squared Radio and order the book today. There is something about to happen to the Earth. You know it. You can feel it. Well, the creators of the Kill Shot have collected the evidence for you in a stunning new documentary called The Horizon Project. The first DVD is now in print, and you can get it by clicking on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio. Believe me when I tell you this may be the most important video production you will ever see. This is destined to air on the Discovery Channel or the History Channel, but you need the uncut version. Click the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio and get your copy today. Many people write us here at X Squared Radio wanting to know how to get prepared for the coming cataclysm. Well, we have been successful in acquiring the best affiliate in the world for emergency preparedness. NitroPak has been around for 18 years and can provide everything you need for life. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a year's supply of excellent quality foods and supplements for a single person or whole family. Don't be left without the essentials of life. NitroPak is the name. Click the banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysm? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two of the theories that are sweeping the world with this message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. A lot of people ask me, where did you come up with the name X Squared Radio? Well, I will tell you. When putting together the idea for this radio program, we thought of X Squared Radio because we wanted all the results to be positive. We wanted the guests to be able to come on and tell their story to the fullest extent that they can, without attacking them, without putting them on the spot. We try to use all the resources we can to bring out the best we can in them. There is one number multiplied by itself which ends up negative, and that is the imaginary number I. It is the square root of negative one. So I try to leave I out of the radio program and try to get the guest to do as much as they can here. So that's where X Squared Radio came from. Our guest this half hour is Ralph Ring. He is a brilliant, innovative technician who, as a young man in the late 1950s and early 60s, worked closely with Otis T. Carr. With the aid of his small team, Carr, who was himself a protege of the great inventor Nikola Tesla, built a number of flying discs, which worked prior to their experimentation being forcibly terminated by government agents. And we hope to reinvigorate that program. So please welcome with me Ralph Ring. Are you on the phone?
Yes, I am.
Ah, excellent, excellent. And we're also here with Michael Sala. He's on the other line with us. Are you there, Michael?
Yes. Aloha, Ralph.
Aloha, Michael.
Oh, we're so glad to have you on the program, Ralph. So you're going to be speaking at the Earth Science and Earth Spirit and Science Spirit and Earth Transformation Conference, right?
That's correct.
All right. And what is going to be the subject of your presentation?
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about Nikola Tesla and Otis Carr and, of course, the OTC-X1 spacecraft that we were developing and operating.
Oh, outstanding, outstanding. Well, for the next 30 minutes, we are all yours. So where would you like to start?
Well, let's see. I guess a little background. I went in and out of the service. When I got out, I was in the infantry and just had a limited education in machine guns and heavy mortars and so forth, so I didn't know what to do, but I had learned to when I was on Guam to skin dive and snorkel, so I created a diving business in San Francisco, California. And it grew, and I moved my operations down to where my parents were, which was Newport Beach, California. And I met a lady, and we got married and started a family. And I kept, I had different phases of diving, research and development, and all kinds of exploration of diving. And one day we were out, a dive boat from U.S. Divers Corporation pulled up. They'd heard about some of the exploits that I was involved with, and they asked me if I would care to join them in their R&D department. And I'm just cutting this kind of short because I've got a lot to cover for you if you'd like.
Oh, that's okay.
Okay. So I said, sure, and they hired me. And so I was then working in the R&D department developing the wraparound mask. And jobs were getting a little more technical and a little more dangerous. My wife kind of wanted me home with the kids and got concerned about my safety. So I was offered a job, and this was Jacques Cousteau. He was the one that had developed the Aqualung in U.S. Divers. And I was asked that if and when they developed the a Calypso 2 on the West Coast, if I would be interested in becoming the head diver, and I said yes. But it was down the down the line a ways, and as I was waiting for that to develop, I got more and more dangerous jobs to fulfill, and my wife got kind of concerned. So one day she addressed advertisement for the classified ad for a research and development laboratory technician in a research laboratory. And she said, well, you tinker all the time and everything. Why don't you go in and see what you can do? Well, my background was very limited, and I didn't have a technical or a scientific background at that time. But I went in anyway, and to make a long story short, Dr. Weinhardt, this was, the name of the company was Advanced Kinetics, and it was a government-funded facility. And as I was trying to apply for the job, they were all out to lunch, and Dr. Weinhardt called me into his office and asked me what I was doing, and I told him I was looking for work. And asked for my credentials, I said I was raised in the woods. I learned everything about nature that I could, and I studied natural law, and my forte was magnetics. And so he became kind of interested, and I told him I had walked out of physics class when the teacher was telling me that a bumblebee couldn't aerodynamically fly. And I looked out the window, and there was a bumblebee staring me straight in the eyes. So I made a decision to go back to nature. And so long story short, this got me involved with studying more and more about natural law and developments and things. And he said that his engineer that was working on a magnetic project had quit and that he needed a replacement right away and to come to work tomorrow morning. I hadn't even filled out an application. But anyhow, I did. I came
Danger
in.
Was your middle name, so you were ready to go to work.
I beg your pardon?
I said Danger was your middle name, so you were ready to go to work. And I don't know if our listeners realize this or not, but back in the days when early diving was done with the Aqualung, it wasn't the nice, slick, lightweight BC thing that you use when you go to Hawaii now. These things were heavy, and the hoses were hard to handle, and you really had to be an athlete to be a diver.
Oh, that's correct. that's for sure. Well, anyway, he put me on this. My job was to and without deflection, fire electrons through a magnetic field and get from point A to point B without deflection. And I had a cathode ray tube firing the electrons, and I had a big oscilloscope and a high-speed Polaroid camera, which I took pictures of each and every firing. And I never once got the electron through the field without deflection. So I thought, well, this is kind of monotonous, and I don't think it's ever going to work because they're using brute force, and I've learned from nature you either get along with nature or forget it, because brute force, she's going to win every time. So I, the next bench over was working on levitation, and they would take out giant, about 2-foot coils, which were called igniotrons in those days, and they'd fire them up and levitate a steel ball for about 8 minutes and then burn out a coil, go check another one out. And in the course of a day, they were using up 7, 8 to 10, maybe even 12 coils at $400 a copy. And my job, I was running up at least $1,000 a day on film and everything. So I, long story short, I've always been a tinkerer, and I had a bunch of junk around the house. And I had oscilloscopes and everything at the house. And I put together the same magnetic experiment by taking a television apart and getting the cathode ray to fire these electrons, only I knew that you don't force nature. So I pulsed the signal. That means in microseconds, I just paused instantaneously, so allowing the electron to spiral through the center without going direct. And the first shot I made went right through, and the next 20 to 30 shots went through without deflection.
So did you take your idea back to work the next day?
Yeah, I did. And along with the levitation thing, I took a 15-inch woofer speaker, put it on the living room floor, and wound up with a ping pong ball being levitated all night long. And I woke up in the morning and it was still there. So I said, well, there it is. There's something here. I'm just a mountain boy, natural, inquisitive kid, but I think I got something. So I took it in, I wrote it all up and took pictures, took it in to Dr. Weinhardt, and he looked at it and said, I never dreamed you'd get this far in this, so now I've got to tell you what this world is all about. And he said, I know this is true. I know it's that simple. It's really that simple. But you're working here for a government-funded R&D, research and development laboratory, that is funded by the taxpayers to look for answers but not find them. And that kind of blew me out of the water. I was under the impression I was going to get a raise and a promotion and everything else. And he said, no, that's not the way it is. And to go back to work and don't talk about this, not even to the other engineers or anything, just go back to work, which I did for another 2 weeks, and got so bored I finally had to quit. Well, just before I quit, I had met these people that I was talking with that belonged to a brainstorming group called Understanding. This was in Costa Mesa, California. And they said, well, come on over and talk to some other people. I told them that, everybody thought I was nuts. And they said, well, come on over and talk to some more nuts. And no. We'll get along good. So I did. I went over and we talked about alternative energies and what the simplicities of natural law are. It's so simple that anybody could do them unless they complicate it by getting in their own way. So they said, well, you know, you're talking like a guy that's stuck right now in Oklahoma City, or in Norman, Oklahoma. His name is Otis Carr, and he's developed spaceships, and he's even applied for a patent, including the levitation device that would levitate the craft, and the patent office refused his patent unless he pulled the levitation device out of it and called it an amusement device and anchored it to the ground, so which he had to do.
Wow.
Yeah. So, but people were kind of upset and angry, and they thought that he was not on the up and up and so forth. So the group said, well, you and him are talking the same language, because I had always wanted to build floating homes for people, and then floating cities later, and floating countries. Something from out of the Flintstone to the Jetson thing that I fully felt then, as I do now, that we're really behind our technology. The technology that's alive and well is being used, but not by us. It's being used by the few and not by the many. So this prompted them to say, well, we'd like to get you and Carr together and see what you can do. So they got a hold of Carr and his entourage. They had about six or eight different engineers and public relations people, and Wayne Aho, Arthur Aho, there was a lot of other people that came out with him. And we decided to go ahead and build some prototypes and some larger models and demonstrate them to the public so that they could see that this is a reality and operating on very simple principles. And we were using magnetic energy, which is all around us. We live in an ocean of energy. And it can be used to do anything we want to with. Well, they put us up in a cabin up in Lake Arrowhead, California, and said, we're going to find a facility so you guys can, you know, get together and start producing these things. So we did. We went up and brainstormed for about a week, all of us, and it was the most enlightening time of my life, because Otis Carr was brilliant on natural law, natural sciences, and we traded experiences that we've had with nature, and we just were aching to get to work and building some floating homes or spaceships. So about a week later, they called us and said, we've got a lab in Apple Valley, Hesperia, California, and that if you guys want to go down and go to work, we're all set. So long story short, we went down, and it had everything. It had machine shops and warehouse and offices and laboratory facilities. And we started right away. We were working day and night building prototypes. And I was just the lab tech and a kind of a gopher for the outfit, but I was very, very involved with some of the experiments, one of which was a 3-foot model that we were vibrating with a something similar to an audio amplifier, the same thing I used on the woofer speaker to get the ping pong ball to levitate, only this was a 3-foot circular foil craft, a little prototype made out of aluminum, and we started vibrating the disc. I was touching it, and I kept touching it, and pretty soon it was like jello. It was getting softer and softer.
The aluminum got soft?
Huh?
The aluminum itself got soft?
The aluminum got like jello. Just exactly like jello. And then my fingers went right into through the aluminum, which is, I realize if you'd never heard of it, such a thing sounds pretty far-fetched, but that's what happened, and that's what it was all about. Well, the explanation for this and other things that we're into from Carr was passed down to him from Tesla, that natural law is so simple and so easy to operate that our conventional sciences have overlooked the simplicity either innocently or deliberately. And, excuse me, I'm running out of air. I got to breathe a minute.
I understand.
Anyway, so he explained that what we were working with is ether technology, something like quantum mechanics and quantum physics, only it dealt with a higher understanding of natural law than our conventional sciences, and in a simple analogy, in a magnetic field, it's like an opera singer with high C can break a crystal, or a guitar strung on one side of the room can vibrate and string can vibrate the string on the other side of the room, and it's called resonance frequencies. And when I was in the service at Fort Ord, California, we had a bridge that we had to cross every day to go to the firing range, and it kept collapsing, and we had to double time to the facility back and forth every day, and excuse me, I had to get a drink of water.
That's all right.
And the bridge kept collapsing, so we called in the engineers and the scientists, and they said, oh, well, we finally found out it was the resonant frequency of our feet when we were going across the bridge reached the resonant frequency of the bridge on the molecular level, and the bridge collapsed. So this is called a resonance.
So from then on, you didn't walk in step going across the bridge. Everybody walked in a random step, so you didn't set up that vibration in the bridge.
And yeah, that's exactly it. That's exactly what happened, and the darn thing kept collapsing. So after they realized it and rebuilt the bridge, we went across the bridge quite differently.
I saw recently an episode of MythBusters, and they had a small solenoid on a 6-inch I-beam, and they just use it like you said, resonance, but as a constructive interference. They found the resonant frequency of the beam, and then they vibrated the solenoid at the resonant frequency of the beam, and within about a minute, this beam was deflecting. It was deflecting about 8 or 9 inches, and at the beginning of the show, both of the hosts of the show stood on the beam, and it wouldn't deflect a quarter of an inch. This thing was a very stiff beam, but this thing was deflecting up and down about 8 or 9 inches from this little 1-pound solenoid going up and down at the right frequency on it. It was incredible.
There's a tremendous amount of power in magnetics, and the one that has either accidentally or been deliberately overlooked, I'm not sure which, but, well, I have ideas, but anyway, Carr explained that it's quite natural and quite normal when you reach the resonant frequency of anything. And then Tesla himself, I don't know if you've heard of his vibrating the Manhattan area with a resonant frequency and causing gigantic earthquakes.
Sure.
Buildings were starting to collapse when they had to stop him from vibrating the vicinity. Well, anyway, because I know we're running out of time, we graduated from the little guy, and we were flying them around the Apple Valley area, and they would glow, and the corona around the periphery of the ship would glow, and the people thought they were flying saucers, so they started getting a lot of looky-loos and people trying to find out what we were doing, and so we had a prototype build up, small one, another 3-footer. We took it. We had an arrangement to talk to General Motors because if we could get them to manufacture these spaceships or floating homes, then we would half our work would be done for us. So we had a meeting at Riverside, California, with the representative from General Motors, sat down with a Mr. Carr demonstrator. We had our engineers, and they had their, they looked at the disk, floated, levitated it above their desk, and the engineers and stuff examined it. And the representative, we said, well, can you help us develop these things further to the next level? And they said, he said, heck no, we don't, there's no money in this. You're running off of energy that we don't know or understand. There's no money in that. If you've got it out of the atmosphere, and there's plenty of atmosphere, you get more of it, and that's not in our line of business. And you're gonna, if you get those things up and you claim that they can't have accidents, the insurance companies aren't going to be interested in that. And so it's the end result was, he said, if you put them up, we'll shoot them down. He said, you're interfering with our monetary system. So the car got really discouraged. We left and realized that our game was just about up. There was somebody who was going to come in and ask us to quit, which they did eventually. But before they did, we had a 45-foot craft that we had built and ready to test. And I was one of the lucky people, fortunate people, to be asked to be one of the three to test it out. So we did, and we got on board. There was a like a crystal ball center, near the center of the craft. It had a laser coming up through the bottom. And Carr said, now what you're going to do, and this is after a lot of briefing, we knew then a little bit about ether technology. It has to do with time and space, that, and teleportation, which Carr was very familiar with, and he got his information from Tesla, that teleportation is the same thing that we talked about, resonant frequency. You reach the resonant frequency of anything, you become your free agent. Similar to the bumblebee, I went out and found out the reason bumblebees do what they do is they levitate. The teacher that told us they don't aerodynamically fly was correct, but I later found out that they have a resonator cavity next to their larynx, and as they beat their wings, it reaches their surrounding frequencies. In this case, it happened to be the Earth's frequency, 8.5 hertz or cycles per second. Once you reach that resonant frequency, it creates its own force field around its body and actually levitates.
How about that? That's kind of interesting.
My assistant here says I'm just about running out of time, so I'll tell you that the test was successful. We got on board and fired this up. The crystal ball illuminated into 100,000 different colors, from infrared all the way around to ultraviolet. And Mr. Carr said we're going to an area about 10 miles downrange, which equates to, in frequencies, the color aquamarine. And excuse me. And so when we start vibrating this crystal, it will vibrate the entire craft to the frequency of aquamarine. I'm trying to cut it short. There's a little more, there's a lot more detail to it, but
that's all right.
Simply what it is. So we fired it up, and he said that it's synergetic, which we understood by then, that we had to be in almost like a meditative mode. We had to feel this color just kind of
permeate.
Yeah, we had this, and this would cause it to work. So we went downrange in the experiment, and we were told, I don't remember how we were in communication. We didn't have cells in or anything, but I could remember hearing Carr's voice very, very clearly. He said, boys, get out of the ship. I want you to start picking up sticks and stones and whatever, put them in your pocket, get familiar where you're at, get back on board, and I'll bring you back, which he did. And now I didn't, for months, or at least weeks after that, remember those details I just told you. I don't remember getting out of the ship or anything then. I do now, and I didn't. I did that
take
about
any
a week.
Film? Did they take any film or photographs of the 45-foot ship flying?
Yes. Oh, yeah. There was a lot of photographs taken. But when we left the pod where we were at the lab, we were gone about 5 seconds. We lifted off the ground, vibrated at the frequency of aquamarine, and went downrange and got out and did our thing and got back on board, which to us equated to about 15 minutes.
Right.
And so when we got back, Carr said, we're going to debrief now. Come on down. And for the three of us, we honestly felt that the thing didn't work. We had no sensations at all of movement. We didn't even realize we'd even gone anywhere or done anything. So until Carr said, empty your pockets. And when we looked in our pockets, of course, we had all this junk in our pockets, rocks and sticks and everything. And he said, that's simple teleportation. For lack of a better explanation, it's kind of a man-made idea of a beginning and an end. But in reality, it's just a creation. It's just an illusion because we go from infinity to infinity. There is no time unless we create it. And so that you guys went on our clocks 5 seconds out of time, on your clocks 15 minutes out of time, and then came back. So I see I'm running close on time. Long story short, the word got around. They found out where Carr was operating, and they showed up one day with their entourage and said that we are going to have to shut you down and seize all your stuff, which they started to do before we could even talk to them. And they had a piece of paper that said we were attempting to overthrow the monetary system in the United States. This could be equated to high treason, and that we were not to do any further work on these projects or anything related to them, or not talk about them to anybody, and that we would be very closely watched. And if we attempted to do anything along these lines, we would face dire consequences. So I don't know how much time I got left, but that's part of the story.
Well, that's it for the 30 minutes. And if our listeners want to hear any more of Ralph Ring and his story, you're going to have to go to the Science, Spirit, and Earth Transformation Conference in Hawaii, which I'm going to be at, and I'm going to be at Ralph's presentation, and I'm going to be glued to my chair because I want to hear the rest of his story. We greatly appreciate you coming on X Squared Radio, and I don't know, where's Otis Carr now? Has he passed away?
Yeah, he passed away about 7 or 8 years ago.
Okay. So is there enough of his notes laying around that this kind of project could be picked up and reconstituted?
We are in the process. We have been. I've never stopped working on a project. From two moving parts, which the original craft was, we've now gone to solid-state circuitry and digital technology. And we have small pods, small little groups of people all over the United States, and just kind of Mother Earth people or homespun inventors, although they're engineers and they're quite qualified in what they're doing, but they're working on alternative energies, one of which is a spaceship. And we expect that due to the present conditions on the Earth, we're not going to be deterred this time. I think there's enough people that know that the change is imminent and has to be brought about. So we suspect within the next couple of years, the whole picture on the economic field and on the transportation field will be drastically changed.
Well, we'll have to put you in touch with the folks down at Phoenix Science Foundation. They are currently working on trying to set up a manufacturing facility in eastern Kentucky.
Wow.
Which, which doesn't, they don't invent anything, but the manufacturing skills come from the automotive industry, the ability to bring any kind of technology to full production using a Six Sigma and lean manufacturing techniques. And they're all about trying to bring new energy to the consumer level. And we'll just put you in touch with those folks. I'll connect up with you when I get to Hawaii and give you some more details on that. Or you can go to PhoenixScienceFoundation.org and make a contact. And we'll see what we can do to get that moving forward. And we really appreciate you coming on the program tonight.
Well, I really appreciate you having me. Thank you very, very much. And Michael, if you're still there, aloha, and aloha to you both, and I'll see you in Hawaii.
Very good. Michael, you still there?
I sure am, and I'll see you in Hawaii, Ralph. Aloha.
Okay, Michael. Aloha.
All right. Stay healthy, my friend. Good night.
Good night, man.
All right. What we're going to do now, our producer is going to dial up our next guest, who is Leonid Sharashkin. I hope I'm pronouncing that right, Michael, am I?
Sharashkin, yes, that's okay. The pronunciation.
And he is, I understand, an expert in agroforestry, which is widely practiced in Russia, with over 35 million families cultivating more than 8 million hectares of land. It is clearly the largest supply of agricultural products through small-scale farms in any civilized country. He's also the editor of the Ringing Cedars book series, which places greater emphasis on integration of trees into agro-ecosystems. So as soon as we get Leonid Sharashkin on the phone, we'll have him join us. Go ahead.
Yes, he's a fascinating speaker. He's one of the people that really is critical in bringing to the United States information about the Anastasia phenomenon, because it really is a phenomenon there in Russia and Europe, where millions of books have been sold about this Siberian teacher, a recluse really, who has revealed information about permaculture practices that can really revolutionize the agricultural industry and also help people.
Hello?
Yes, hello, Leonid. How are you this evening?
I'm very good, thank you. It's not evening here, though.
Oh, well, this is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio, and we have Dr. Michael Sala on the other line with us.
Great. Hello, Brooks, and hello, Michael.
Aloha, Leonid.
All right. We did a brief introduction. We were talking about you. You were an expert in agroforestry, and we talked about the project in Russia, where literally 35 million families are living on small farms, integrating trees into their agro ecosystem, and it seems to be working.
And not only that, also there is a huge cultural and spiritual dimension to this practice. But what you mentioned, this 35 million families, and this is 70% of the country's population, they are now producing 54% of Russia's total agricultural output. And this is the statistics, the official statistics that you do not really hear talked about in mass media. Because when you think about it, Russian gardeners now prove that it is possible to feed the world just with home gardens. You don't need the huge machinery, you don't need industrial farms, pesticides, genetically modified organisms. Russian gardeners today in an industrially developed country have proven that it is possible to feed the world, and Russia is a living example, just with people's home gardens.
That's completely fascinating. You know, I live in rural western Kentucky, and just about everybody here has a small garden, and my in-laws have, a few acres, which provides way more food than they can consume. And even one of our founders, Thomas Jefferson, said that people should, you know, live on mini farms, as it were, and really grow most of their own food.
Exactly. And when you consider that home gardens are not dependent on oil availability, they are not dependent on machinery availability or capital availability, If something collapses and there is a shortage of fuel sales, industrial farming will not be able to carry on. And besides, it won't be able to carry on in case there is an economic crisis and it receives no subsidies from the government. And now the proponents of industrial heavy agriculture continue to argue that maybe GMOs and industrial farming is not the best thing, but yet it is inevitable in order to be able to prevent world starvation. And this is not, absolutely not so, and Russian gardeners show that it is not so, because they do produce 54% of Russia's agricultural output, more than all the commercial farmers together, on just 3% of agricultural land in the country. And in terms of the volume of the produce that they are producing, they outcompete not only just the commercial agriculture. They produce more in terms of their contribution to the national economy than oil refining industry, than construction industry, than steel industry, pulp and paper industry. This is the foundation of the national economy, and unfortunately, this is the fact which is not acknowledged readily by the government or politicians, neither back in Russia nor elsewhere in the world.
Well, it sounds like it would be a very stable ecology, because it doesn't sound like any kind of catastrophe would wipe the people out. In other words, if the fuel stopped flowing, or if there was a power plant that went down, or a road or a river that got wiped out, or a dam that burst, it doesn't sound like these people would be isolated at all, that they'd have everything they need to support themselves and their communities locally.
Exactly. The staples are produced by people themselves. 54%, this is the total agricultural produce. But in terms of the staples, the traditional Russian staple, potatoes, 92% of potatoes, 92% are produced by families themselves. So you're totally correct. In case anything happens with the economy or agriculture, Russians will be able to survive. I'm not so sure about other countries.
No, but our country, if you go to our cities, they're all concrete, and people that live in condos and apartments, they don't typically have gardens. They don't. In fact, most people that I know that live in condos in the city have barely a 3-day supply of food in their entire household.
True. You know, the Russian gardeners, the majority of them are people who live in large cities, and they do not have backyards. They usually live in large apartment blocks. But every weekend, even people who are really very well off, they travel to their gardens outside the city limits and spend their weekends digging potatoes or planting their herbs. And one of the most fascinating things also is that this is not being done because the country is poor or because people have nothing to eat. Not at all. You have wealthy people who do this the same way poor people do. For example, in the community where I live, there are people who are so well off. In one day, they could earn enough money to buy a 1-year supply of food, and still they prefer to spend their weekends digging a potato patch, reconnecting to the earth.
Well, I would think, too, that the quality of food that you get out of your own garden, vine-ripened tomatoes, vegetables that have not been frozen, that are fresh right out of the garden, they taste so much better. And not only that, they're free.
They are. The only thing you need is a pair of your hands and very simple gardening tools.
Well, I like it. We've been doing it, for 25 years in my family. I remember one time we were digging potatoes that we'd planted, and we'd had an unusually large crop, and my two boys, who were young at the time, were digging the potatoes and putting them into a wheelbarrow, and they were missing some. They were leaving some behind in the dirt, and my father-in-law got angry and said, "Get after your boys, you know, they're leaving too many potatoes in the ground." And I said, "Well, with all due respect, I'm not raising potatoes, I'm raising boys."
Exactly. There is so much more to gardening than just growing your food, and it is just reconnecting also with the family and with the community. Actually, in the Russian language, the word family means a seed. So you see that you plan to grow something. So you just, even in the language, you have the knowledge ingrained that growing your food, it is much more than just providing for your physical existence. Actually, if you look at the language, the word cult, C-U-L-T, it means two things. It means religion, reconnecting to God, and at the same time, it means cultivating something, growing things. And this is so because our ancestors made no separation between reconnecting to God and working the land. For them, working the land was the same thing as conversing with God.
Well, that's important to know, and especially in some of these ancient, more ancient religions than modern religions, who are really nothing more than quasi-governments. Dealing out welfare and trying to control the intelligent growth of people. Before that, well before that, when we're talking about large agricultural societies, the earth was actually considered an entity, one with whom you had to commune on a regular basis, and that was done through farming.
Exactly so, and you know, even modern science, for example, psychology, they bear out these truths. For example, there have been studies made with recovery of patients from very serious surgeries, and they've shown that even people who were in a room with windows and trees and green grass in front of the window, they were recovering faster than those who were deprived of the opportunity just even to see living nature out of their window in their hospital room.
Well, there is something therapeutic about planting something in the ground and then watching it grow and then yielding the fruit of your labor. It's just something invigorating and enlightening about it.
Exactly. And, you know, I will also be speaking about this exactly aspect of it. The food that you grow will be like no other food for you, because you will establish this particular relationship with this particular plant that will produce you your food. And we have a series of books published in Russia today in which I am translating and editing, making available them in the English language, that argues exactly this, that plants, they can modify their fruit to suit the needs of a particular person who is growing this plant. If you provide these plants with enough information about your bodily state. And when you look at the ancient fertility rites, there were ancient practices when human blood or sperm or sweat was applied to fields in order to promote fertility. I think these practices, these ancient practices, were just grounded in this understanding that there is not just a flow of nourishment, physical nourishment and energy, from the plant world to the humans, but there is, and there should be, a reverse flow of information and energy and nourishment from us people back to the plant world. And if you do not close this loop, then you cannot be hoping to have a really ideal nutrition for us, because this loop and this connectedness, physical connectedness to nature through the food that you consume every day is broken.
Can I ask a question here of Lena? Because I think this is a very important issue that he just brought up about the connection of the farmers with the land. I mean, what's the cumulative effect of millions of farmers in Russia suddenly taking up these small-scale agricultural pursuits and using these principles that you have seen being promoted in the Anastasia book series in terms of the helping the planet or Gaia as a consciousness feel that humanity is playing a much more responsible stewardship role here?
Yeah, you know, in Russia it happened very naturally when the Soviet Union collapsed. All of the industrial agriculture and the collective farms that were run by the government, they collapsed overnight because they were no longer receiving subsidies and financial support from the state. And all of a sudden, people in the country realized that the vitality and viability of farming or gardening is not in the hands of the state, of the government. It is in everybody's hands. And the number of the families who garden increased dramatically, up to 35 million families today. And in this, I see just the continuation of the ancient tradition of living on the land and working on the land that was germane to Russia for the last millennia.
Wow, that is fantastic. So we're not just talking about the benefits of growing your own food and maybe having some organic benefits from that and living a healthier life. We're also talking about returning human consciousness, human personality, human needs and intent back to the plant itself and also to the planet.
It is undoubtedly so. You know, in Russian, the word nature means, if you translate it literally, word by word, it means attached to God. So our ancestors had the understanding, as you pointed out earlier, that this is not separate. Your working the land is not separate from religion. This is the religion. This is the way to reconnect to the original source. And reconnecting to the earth provides what people have been trying to obtain through the established churches, etc., often without much success. It provides you the rich lifestyle, full of joy, and the feeling that you are grounded, that you are here for something. And, you know, people who practice gardening in Russia, they don't have as much trouble figuring out the purpose of their existence, because they have this first-hand experience of communicating with this living deity on a daily basis.
Do you think that it would be possible in this country that people that have a fair amount of land, say 200-400 acres, could make a business by renting out a portion of their land to these small gardeners who would come out, say, with a quarter of an acre, which would be a huge garden, by the way, and provide them the land that they can come out and grow their own food?
Yes, either renting out or selling, because I'm sure that this is going to happen in the United States sooner or later. When you remember the Great Depression and World War II, the so-called Victory Gardens, they proliferated through the whole country, because growing your own garden was a matter of physical survival for many families.
Sure.
And
sure.
Russian example with the collapse of the USSR and the very dire economic circumstances shows that whenever there is a crisis, a really serious economic crisis, people suddenly remember what their life is all about and where all their food is coming from. And fortunately, people do remember that it is actually very easy to plant your own garden and grow your own food. You just plant a seed, take care of it, and it grows food for you. So I do think that the future of farming and agriculture is in making it much smaller in size. When you look at the Russian example, now in terms of the land usage, Russian gardeners are 40 times more efficient than industrial farms. Because, of course, an industrial farmer, even a small farmer by American standards, one with 100 or 200-300 acres, he cannot possibly take care of each particular plant on his farm. While a gardener with one-tenth of an acre, and this is the standard size of a garden plot in Russia, just one-tenth of an acre. They can take care of each individual plant, know each individual plant, and, of course, make it so productive, much more productive than you could ever achieve in an industrial farm situation.
Well, sure. I mean, a gardener is going to go out and pull the weeds out of his garden, whereas a big farmer, he's going to use an herbicide to kill off the weeds, which is going to get in the food eventually.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, there is another thing that makes this gardening practice so vastly different from industrial agriculture. This is that gardening is not about making money. I recently conducted a study in Russia, in one of Russia's regions, and it showed that most people grow their food just for the sake of providing this food for their family table. And even the surplus that they have, because most of them do grow more food than they can eat, instead of selling it, Some of them, of course, do sell it, but most people just give it out for free to their extended family, to relatives and for friends. And because of this, some of the economists, Orthodox economists coming to Russia, they argue that Russian gardening practices make no economic sense because they do not contribute to the monetary economy. But to me, it's an indication that on the opposite, it represents an economy of not competition, but economy of cooperation, when people are growing their food to benefit themselves, their families, their communities, and there is no monetary gain involved in it. And just as you pointed out, the difference between the weeding practices in small gardens, when you can pull up the weeds that you do not like, and huge farms where you have to use herbicides in order to protect your crop. So the same is the difference between the gardens and the large farm operations in terms of the motivation. When people grow food just for their families and for the ones they love, of course they're making it in a way different from that of large commercial farmers, because they're not doing it for profit, they're not doing it for money. They see in it a practice that not only brings them food to eat, but also reconnects them to the source.
Well, I know in this country a garden can save you $300, sometimes $400 a month in a food bill. So in a sense, you are saving money that you can then spend on something else. But there are other benefits of living in a permaculture, the ability to feel as though you can provide for yourself no matter what your income level is a very important social stability, a social strength that a nation, and in this case 35 million families, that is a lot of stability for a country.
Also, yeah, when you take into consideration that they do not only plant annual crops like potatoes, vegetables. People also plant trees that will produce food not only for them, but for their children and grandchildren, pears and apple trees and nut trees. So when you think about the stability and food security, this garden that the family establishes, this becomes intergenerational wealth. This is a very direct and realistic way to provide for the future of your children and make an investment, and in real terms, make an investment in something that will take care of your children and grandchildren for many, many decades and many, possibly many centuries to come.
Well, I like it. It's a great idea. It's a great energy. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it. I don't know why we became a country that we go to Super Walmart for just about everything we need, and that's the way it is. We just walk down the aisles and we fill up our cart with items that have not ripened on the vine, but ripened in a truck, in a box. They were picked green, and they just happen to look good on the shelf, but they're not nearly as vibrant and full of nutrients as those that you could grow for yourself, and it's not near as fun. So it's great what you're doing, and I love your energy, and I can't wait to hear you at the expo.
Okay, thanks, Berg. You know what you're saying is also true, actually, in Russia, when Vladimir Megre, the author of Anastasia and the Ringing Cedars books, which I will be presenting on at the conference, when he first wrote this book about this connection to the land and the significance of these gardens, not just for the national economy, but also as a continuation of the tradition of living on the land, guess what? His manuscript was rejected by all publishers he showed it to. Because publishers thought that the only thing that can sell well in the marketplace is stories about violence, sex, and drugs. And anything about nature and spirituality is not going to sell well. So he went ahead and self-published it, and the book ended up selling 10 million, and its sequences ended up selling 10 million copies in Russian alone.
And she got to keep a lot more of the royalties, too. So the publishers missed out on that one, didn't they?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I like it. What a great success story. And I love the Anastasia books, just the covers and the back of them and the the storyline in it and how agriculture is weaved into the culture. It is just amazing. It's very uplifting, and I highly recommend the Ringing series, the Ringing Cedars book series. All right, that brings us to the top of the hour, and our guest has been Leonid Shereshkin, and if you want to hear him speak, you need to go to the Science, Spirit, and Earth Transformation Conference in Hawaii in May, and of course you can click on that banner at X Squared Radio and sign up, because that's what we're all about tonight, is to try to generate interest for that and allow our speakers to tell a brief part of their story. We appreciate you being on our program tonight so much.
Thank you, Brooks. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Leonid.
Thank you.
And see you soon at the conference.
Yes, absolutely. All right, my friends. That brings us to the top of our second hour. We have one more hour to go. Steve Bassett is going to be our guest. You don't want to miss that, so hang out, and we'll be back after these messages. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio. Possible you've existed for thousands of years? The new book in the Universal Learning Series by Sandy Andrew called Your Never-Ending Life will shine light on memories you once dismissed as impossible. When you're finished with this book, you will realize why and how you can relish all the beauty and sadness in all your lives. Search your higher mind, find your soulmate, and know that you are never alone in this world. You can find the book easily by clicking the Universal Learning Series banner at X Squared Radio. Just about everyone owns an inkjet printer. You could buy a printer for less than a couple of tanks of gas. But the inkjet cartridges are costly. If you buy a color and black cartridge at a national superstore, you'll spend about $80. Well, those high-priced days are now over. If you click the 123 inkjet banner at X Squared Radio, you may be able to replace a cartridge for the price of movie admission for two. Plus, every time you shop at 123 Inkjet, you get a chance to win a free printer. How cool is that? Add to that the free shipping, and you have an untouchable bargain. Next time you run low on those vibrant color inks, think of X Squared Radio and start saving money. You know, dust is a place where the past meets the future. If you have done your genealogy and found that you have roots in the Irish or Scottish clans, then don't you think it would be a great idea to have a replica of your family crest? You can get a coat of arms, a ring, or even a family tartan that may help you or your grandchildren remember your ancestors. This is the time when the hearts of the children are turned to the hearts of the fathers. We only carry the best. So if you're ready to experience the glory of your past, you're ready to visit Scottish heirlooms at X Squared Radio. Many people write us here at X Squared Radio wanting to know how to get prepared for the coming cataclysms. Well, we have been successful in acquiring the best affiliate in the world for emergency preparedness. NitroPak has been around for 18 years and can provide everything you need for life. They have everything, from 72-hour kits to a year's supply of excellent quality food and supplements for a single person or whole family. Don't be left without the essentials of life. NitroPack is the name. Click the banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysm? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two of the series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. This is Brooks Agnew, your host, coming to you from deep beneath the earth in western Kentucky. My AccuWindow forecast is it's about 74, 75 degrees here. Very nice weather. We're enjoying this spring. In fact, I was down at the local Farrell's hamburger place, and it was kind of interesting because this is a place that was established in 1929, and sometimes they have a young guy that works the grill, and he comes up to people and asks them, what do you want? And the people have been coming there for so long that it's just, we don't even take their order anymore. We just know what they want. They just throw it on the grill. It's just one of those country places that we go to have breakfast in the morning. And the waitress made the comment this last Saturday when we went there for breakfast that she likes work in the summers because she likes to fish and she knows she's going to get a couple dollars in tips, which is enough to buy her worms. So that's why she works down at the local Farrell's. Our guest this half hour is Steve Bassett. He is arguably the leading advocate in the nation for ending the 60-year government-imposed truth embargo regarding an extraterrestrial presence engaging the human race and the planet Earth. He is a political activist, lobbyist, commentator, and columnist. He is the founder of the Paradigm Research Group, the executive director of the Extraterrestrial Phenomenon Political Action Committee, called XPAC, and the author of the Paradigm Clock website. His work has been covered worldwide, including the Washington Post, Washington Times, New York Times, Legal Times, Christian Science Monitor, National Journal, Pravda, London Sunday Express, and Roll Call. Please welcome with me Steve Bassett. Are you on the line?
Hi, Brooks. Nice to be with you.
Oh, excellent. And we also have Michael Sala on the other line with us.
Hi, Steve. How you doing?
Hi, Michael.
All right. You're going to be speaking at the Science, Spirit, and Earth Transformation Conference in Hawaii. And very good bio coming in. I want to know in 35 minutes or less what it is you're going to dazzle us with in Hawaii.
Well, in concert with the more expanded view that this conference, Michael's conference, takes, I mean, he's really brought in a multiplicity of areas of interest, all kind of advanced in their thinking. I'm going to take my normal nuts and bolts approach to the political resolution of this issue and get into the more subtle and esoteric predictions regarding what disclosure, what the ending of this truth embargo will mean to the human race. And that's important because what it means, what it could mean, is part of the decision-making process to end the embargo in the first place. In other words, why do we care? Why do we care that the government prevents us from knowing the truth? Why not just lead our lives and wait for the government to tell us in its own good time? So it is an important issue, and we're gonna take that approach.
Well, so we population people, we normal people out here, believe that the government knows more than they're telling us. And you're right, there's been kind of an embargo. But in order for that to really function, it would seem that there would have to be a single source or maybe two or three sources of contact between extraterrestrials and the government. Because I've been to Washington. It's a bloody zoo. I mean, there's bureaucrats on top of bureaucrats. I don't even really think there is a government up there. I just think it's a cooperative group of people trying to get a government check. How in the world can you embargo something as broad and as universal as contact with ETs?
How many minutes do I have? 30?
Well, actually, we can go a little bit long because our final guest, we still don't have a telephone number for, and I think we are not going to have one. So we might have the whole hour.
Look, you've raised four or five significant exopolitical issues. Let me dispense with them quickly. One, what the government embargoed was the formal acknowledgement of the ET presence. Right, that's what it fundamentally embargoed. It couldn't, quote, hide everything. It couldn't stop ETs from coming and going and being seen and photographed. And the whole range of interactions that have taken place in the last 60 years, that was out of its control. And while certainly it has information, plenty of information about these ETs that it hasn't divulged to us, we also know a lot ourselves from the work of hundreds of researchers over many decades now. So what they embargoed was acknowledging, right, that there is in fact an ET presence. And that was critical because without that formal acknowledgement, a whole host of things were not going to happen, not the least of which is the government was going to have to come up with that technology that they have been working on, ET in origin, derived from crash vehicles, right, if not from vehicles given to them by ETs under some sort of an arrangement. I do not specifically that there are any formal arrangements, and there don't have to be for there to be ET tech in our hands. And the other thing, the embargo allowed the government a little greater latitude of freedom to deal with this issue as it sees fit, to weaponize technology if it wishes to create a defensive or an offensive position with respect to these ETs without people interfering in their policy. So let's be clear. It's hardly a secret. I mean, I've had people in the government tell me that the ETs are here. In fact, almost everyone I know has had someone in the government say, sure, we have ETs. We've got witnesses that have come forward that used to work with the government that have said this. We have astronauts that have said this. It's not a secret, which is what's very troubling about this, because we no longer live in a world where these kinds of games we can afford to play them, these kind of charades, these kind of, don't ask, don't tell, all right, I don't need to know, just go. We can't afford that, because governments are making colossal blunders with respect to a whole range of issues, war, peace, environment. We're getting bad governance, and we're already headed down a very bad path. We need reality-based government, truth-based government. We need an informed, involved citizenry that can influence government when it decides to drive off a cliff. And we don't have that. What we have is kind of an in loco parentis arrangement in which vast elements of secret operations run by secret people serve us like parents serve children. Meaning, look, we can't tell you what we're doing, sonny boy, little girl, but trust, it'll all work out in the end, and we'll let you know when you're old enough to understand it. This is a bad situation that needs to end. And the fastest way, I believe, to break this open is to start with the big one, and that is acknowledge the ET presence. End this embargo, and then we will start a process of bringing the information out into the public arena and dealing with it as a society, as a species, and deciding what we're going to do with respect to these ETs.
Well, what public servant has enough clout, enough credibility, enough bully pulpit to step forward and make such a statement? Okay, for the last 60 years, we have had intimate contact with ETs. We've shot them out of the sky. They shot us out of the sky. And we're sorry, but we're going to disclose all of this to you. Who has the political cojones to be able to pull something like that off and make it credible?
The disclosure of it will be triggered by any number of possible events that could trigger the disclosure process, meaning begin an irreversible, fairly rapidly developing process, probably over a few weeks, a month if not more, ending in disclosure. It can come from a number of directions. It can come from another country. Any number of countries, including France, Canada, Belgium, United Kingdom, possibly Mexico, possibly Brazil, who could unilaterally come forward and say, there is an extraterrestrial presence. We're aware of that. We have held silent on this in agreement with the United States' wishes, but we no longer can do that. And by the way, here's a bunch of gun camera footage from our National Defense Chase planes and during intercepts over the last 20 years.
We were making a little headway on that when Paul Hellyer made his statement.
Yeah, I'm including all of that. I'm including all of the events. I'm tracking them all. Events in France and the UK, events in Canada. And that's why I'm making the statement. Without getting into all the particulars, there are circumstances and events going on in these countries that lead me to believe that they're breaking ranks with the U.S. on this issue and may unilaterally take action. And if they do, the U.S. embargo will collapse very quickly. Another potential source would be the executive branch. The executive branch could make a decision to move forward on this and force the issue, and it would be pretty easy to do. While there might be some resistance within certain parts of the military and intelligence community, there will be parts of those communities that will assist. So the executive branch can break it open with an announcement. It could independently come out of the military intelligence community, which is something I've written on recently. There is such a breach now between the executive and the military intelligence community that if a disclosure-oriented group within the intel and the military were to decide to go forward and the executive tried to block them, I think they would rebuff that block and move forward anyway. So it could emerge out of the intelligence community with two or three individuals, high classified positions, coming forward and making some public statements. It could also come from a major player within government. It could be a source so high, an Alexander Haig, Henry Kissinger level, Colin Powell level, Cohen level, who would simply come forward and make a unilateral statement. I think that would trigger an irreversible process. Also, we have been feeding information to the media for decades, no more intensely than in the last 10 years, Every news network, every cable network, I have personally met with journalists. We have sent them reams of material, offers to meet with witnesses. I've sent letters to the publishers of the Washington Post on numerous occasions. They know that something is going on. They know there's a movement out here, and they know that they could deal with it anytime they want to, but they have chosen so far not to. But they could change their mind anytime. And any major paper, LA Times, Washington Post, New York Times, were to suddenly reverse course and go after this issue, I believe that would break the embargo open within a few weeks to a month.
Yeah, it probably would. I know last year there was a UFO special put on by Peter Jennings, and we all, with great anticipation, watched it. But it was rather benign, and they left out some of the best footage and even discredited some of the prime witnesses by not letting them tell their whole story. It was a sham. It was an embarrassment. And they really had a prime opportunity to not only make a great statement, but, my gosh, they could have stolen market share like mad if they would have come out and just broken ranks and said, guess what? The world is round.
Well, to put that in perspective, I mean, I've studied that documentary thoroughly. First hour of the documentary was very strong. I mean, to stop there, it would have been a very powerful piece for further analysis. The second half was essentially a bone tossed to the military intelligence group. So the total of it was kind of benign, but the first half was very strong. Keep in mind that documentary was put together by Peter Jennings' personal production company, PR Productions. They had a huge number of interviews and hours. Only a fraction of their interviews went into that production. I think it's very likely they would have done more follow-ups on that. And I think he planned to do that. But unfortunately, he was diagnosed with lung cancer right about that time, and it was aggressive, and he did not live very long. So it's hard to know what would have happened there. But it was a taste. It was a taste of what could happen. And so there is another a potential source for collapse. So I'm giving you examples of how this embargo could end very quickly and very suddenly. And any one of those, in my opinion, could happen at any moment. I've been very clear about this. Since 1996, the end of the Rockefeller Initiative, we have been in a it-could-happen-any-moment mode with respect to ending this embargo. It was clearly delayed as the Clinton administration came under additional withering attacks and sort of degraded into a soap opera. And when the new president came in, President Bush, it created a window of opportunity, but I think that window was closed by the attacks in New York and in Washington.
Sure.
And things have degraded rather rapidly, as you know. But nevertheless, we're now 16 years after the end of the Cold War. Hundreds of witnesses have come forward. Media is fully aware and been engaged. We have a political movement underway in the U.S., of which I consider myself a part, Canada, U.K., and we're now in a situation where I believe disclosure could happen at any moment. I've said so repeatedly. I've also moved the paradigm clock to 15 seconds to midnight, and I'm sending out press releases. And in fact, I'm right now in the middle of sending out a congressional alert to both the House and the Senate, where I'm basically saying they need to be prepared for this to happen at any moment. In other words,
well, I know there's been a couple of maybe breakthroughs. The film Fast Walkers just debuted, and our friend David Sirita just finished shooting his film with some very, very provocative interviews that have been seen before. So here are two good, very aggressive documentary-style films that are getting ready to sweep the country as well. So there's a lot of momentum on a lot of fronts, and it does feel different, doesn't it?
Out of the Blue is about to be re-released with additional material. In due course, I'm going to be distributing copies of my intention is to distribute a copy of Fast Walkers and a copy of Paul Hellyer's presentation in Toronto in 2005 to every member of the House and Senate, personally hand-delivered with cover letter. That'll happen fairly soon. Out of the Blue re-release is important. Out of the Blue was distributed to the House and Senate by another group a while back. You may or may not know, there have been two secret efforts to have, by the Congress, to have hearings in the last 3.5-4 years. Both of them were shut down before they could get, underway, but we are aware that there were two attempts to do this.
Well,
so,
I didn't know that. I'm on a fairly good speaking basis with Congressman Whitfield and Senator McConnell in my state.
Yeah.
Because I have some efforts going with respect to bringing a new energy manufacturing plant to this state. But I, frankly, you know, have just broached the idea a couple of times about disclosure, and they just sort of laugh it off, like, oh, yeah, that side culture over there, those fringe people. But very soon it's going to gain enough momentum that their constituency is going to be undeniable.
Well, fortunately, we don't need every member of Congress to be mature on this issue. We need perhaps about a half a dozen men, basically a hidden caucus in a way, which is part of what I'll be doing this year. I'm going to be trying to build that caucus by approaching as many members as I can, hopefully on the basis of constituent invitations. In other words, I'm going to be contacting all of my supporters, I have about 10,000 people, and asking them to contact their member and say that you please meet with Mr. Bassett, because they do not like to, they much prefer to do all of their interactions through constituency or with constituents. So I'll be going in and talking to them about trying to create private caucus where people who have a sense of this as being real can get together privately to discuss what to do so that a group of them can move together instead of on an individual basis, like what happened with Steve and Schiff. So that's one of the tactics I'll be doing. But let me make it clear. There are forces at play here far greater than what I can bring to bear on the Washington, D.C., no matter how hard I work. These forces are very powerful. This embargo is near its end. It is very close to ending, and I think extent that the programs continue to bring information out, the witnesses come forward, the conferences continue to be held, and people given a forum, the extent that we continue to confront the media when they act foolish on this issue, keep the pressure on, I think that shortly it will happen. It's possible, my sense is that the Democrats have already planned an event here. I think the Democrats are looking ahead to 2009. Spring of 2009. I'm seeing signs of that in many areas. So what they have done is they decided that they're not going to aggressively pursue or do anything to trigger disclosure if they can avoid it during the Bush administration. But if they succeed in winning the presidency in 2008, I think they have plans for early 2009. And this is based upon my assessment of the activities and actions of John Podesta, who will be a major player in the coming Democratic, how would you say, administration, if there is one, and the lead up to it, as well as Bill Richardson, the governor of New Mexico, who is universally considered the leading candidate for vice president on the next ticket. Both of these men have already spoken out or written specifically to the issue of the embargo in one way or another, which is extraordinary when you consider they're both high members, powerful members of the Democratic Party. A lot of people don't understand this. Other things have been taking place. So my concern, though, is that I'm concerned that they are putting party ahead of the people, meaning, okay, we want to see disclosure, but we want it under our president. We want to do anything now. And this is partisan, and it's not acceptable to me. So I'm going to keep the pressure on. But that said, I will continue to follow what I consider to be an evolving plan on the part of Democrats to disclose during the early months of a Democratic president.
I got a very similar feeling when I was in Washington early this year, because I was discussing the advent of, you know, we don't invent anything, but we are good at bringing manufacturing plants up to speed and producing products. So we tried to hook up with the energy people, and frankly, after the midterm elections, it was like a breath of fresh air in Washington. Doors opened, and people were listening, and it was just a very good feeling that finally it seemed like something was going to break loose in Washington for funding for bringing new energy devices to the consumer level. But that very similar analysis that you just talked about, oh, well, we don't want to allow any kind of real success under this administration. We're going to wait until we have the White House and we can take credit for bringing some of these devices to market. So you're exactly right. I got the feeling that it was definitely party over country.
Well, there's another factor here. Now, I want to state a caveat, and I hope people hear it. PRG has and always will be a nonpartisan organization. It does not pursue the truth on this matter and the end of this embargo on the basis of political affiliation or political partisanship.
I wouldn't
I try to call things as I see them. I try to project what's going to happen as best I can. But some people get mad because, well, you know, it sounds like you're speaking on one half or the other. I'm not. One of the problems is that we're going to be facing an extraordinary amount of political upheaval over the next 6 or 7 months. I've been talking about this a little bit. Let me project it for your audience now.
Sure, go ahead.
I predicted last year that Rumsfeld would be resigning shortly after the shortly before the election. I was mistaken. He resigned right after the election. We're going to see a string of resignations and other processes within a conference that are going to make this year very intense and partisan, which does make it more difficult for any kind of a disclosure event to trigger out of the government. That doesn't mean that one of the foreign governments wouldn't act. But over the next 7 months, you can look for this to happen. Gonzalez is going to resign, probably next. Wolfowitz is going to resign.
Maybe Cheney would resign.
Who would?
I had a feeling that maybe Cheney would resign due to health problems.
I'm getting there. Roe will resign after Wolfowitz, I think. Cheney will resign after Roe. And that will all happen very, very quickly, but over a period of about 6 or 7 weeks. The hearing process is only just getting underway. What's going on now is that the various committees in the House and the Senate are taking private testimonies from whistleblowers up and down the spectrum. This is off the camera, off the site. Nobody knows about those meetings, but they are taking place. This is what they do. When they have taken a sufficient private testimony that they know what they want to bring forward in open committee hearings, they will then start launching additional hearings on a range of subjects. And those hearings are going to be ugly, and they're going to be very intense, and they're going to trigger resignation. The reason that these things will trigger resignation is that serving people in government, particularly constitutional officers, are very restricted in what they can do if they are brought before the Congress in a hearing. In order to minimize those restrictions, they have to resign and become private citizens, and they can lawyer up. So that's why these people have to resign. Cheney will never appear in front of any committee of this Congress. I can assure you that. He will resign before that happens. So you're going to see a string of resignations followed by the impeachment process, which will start, I believe, sometime in mid-summer to late summer, around the end of July, early August. And the impeachment process against the president will get underway at that time. After Cheney resigns, there'll have to be a new president appointed. That president has to be approved by a combined majority of the House and Senate. It will be exactly like the Gerald Ford situation when Agnew resigned. And then the impeachment process will begin against Bush. I believe that then what happens after that depends upon the Senate. If Bush were to continue to lose Senate votes and he drops below, or the amount of support that he has drops below one-third, then the Senate has enough votes to convict, in which case he would resign. So my sense is, I believe there's a better than 50-50 chance that Bush will resign before this year is out, possibly in the fall. You can imagine, therefore, what that means politically in Washington. I mean, we're talking 7 months of tumult, chaos, media blitz, media frenzy, and within that context, it's going to be very difficult for any major issue to get any traction, which then puts us into early 2009, possibly with a new president and a new vice president, having the first appointed vice president sending the presidency, a la Gerald Ford, and then another man behind him brought in as vice president. So I can appreciate why one would make the case that given that before we trip this switch, let's let things settle out and do it under another administration. I don't want to debate that. I mean,
yeah, I don't. you know, we're so late in this last term of Bush and Cheney, and I just don't see the political benefit or the economic benefit of impeaching Bush. I just don't see it. I think, you know, they can stonewall for 9 months, and by the time you do that, you're 7 months away from the election. For crying out loud, by next June, the primaries will be well underway. The momentum for the new election will be underway. Why in the world would you want to sully the election process with an impeachment process?
Well, let me just put it this way, Brooks. There are certain equations in Washington, D.C. that are immutable, and they will always be solved and produce predictable outcomes.
And one is an eye for an eye. You impeach our president, we impeach yours.
Absolutely. Remember, Clinton was impeached far later than my projection on the Bush impeachment process, far later. So essentially, the Democrats are owed one impeachment, and they are going to collect. And you have to understand the impeachment process and the hearing process and the succession of resignations is only going to ensure, in the eyes of the Democrats, that they have a lock on the election in 2008. So essentially, it all serves, in their mind, political purpose, big time, because you have an administration virtually that will, at least from the outside, look like it's completely collapsing inward, and you have people leaving office in disgrace. Now, look, again, I'm not speaking from a nonpartisan position. I would be quite happy if George Bush announced the extraterrestrial presence tomorrow. I don't care who gets the credit for it. And the reason for that is things happen. You make your plans to do it in 2009, and then something gets blown up, or you don't win the election, or who knows what's going to happen. So I can't think that way. We need to get this done tomorrow. But looking at the picture here, which is what I do, that's all I do, I can tell you that there are certain things that are going to happen. You can take it to the bank, and I'm projecting them for you now. The string of resignations, including a bunch of smaller officials, which will resign along with Rove and Cheney and Gonzales and Wolfowitz and so forth. There will be other resignations leading to an isolated president by early summer. The impeachment process will get underway in the House, and then it'll come down to the votes in the Senate. This is exactly parallel to the Nixon experience in 1975, I believe. So look for this. And then our problem is, how do we keep focus on this issue during this? Well, I will do the best I can. Keep the pressure on. Let the media and the public know, and the Congress know, that like this will pass, but the ET issue will not, and that we are going to press this until we get the truth on this, until we get this embargo ended. We're not going to stop ever until you relent on this issue, and then we will start a process, hopefully that will lead to reform and restructuring of a lot of the way the U.S. government operates. Creating what would be a whole new era, perhaps, of openness and transparency starting in 2009 forward.
Well, I love the idea of transparency. I love the idea of some of this technology leaking out into the private sector so that we can stop burning oil the way we're burning it. I don't mind using oil for plastics and solvents and dyes and medicine and all that stuff. It's wonderful, but why are we digging up the planet and shoving it down our gas tank? It just doesn't make any sense to me when there's all this great technology just laying there on the table. All we have to do is manufacture it. But that being said, I'm not sure. That is to say, I'm trying to get convinced that the U.S. government is a major player in this sort of quasi-government that seems to consume a fair amount of the gross national product of numerous nations to fuel this military anti-ET or ET embargo type mentality.
Well, let's just say that power and arrogance always self-destruct. We've seen it over and over again in history.
Sure.
The cabals and the internal groups that have pretty much held sway since 47, have accumulated enormous sums of wealth, uncountable wealth. I mean, it can't even hard to describe it. They have done quite well for themselves. If the embargo ends tomorrow, the oil company execs will all die rich men. The internal guys will all receive the awards that they got coming, and they will retire with full pensions. By and large, there's not a lot of downside to the people that are running the show right now. There may be embarrassment to the families of some of the earlier people, but they're going to be justified in the base of national security in the 70s. They're just, increasingly, there's not that much downside to the overall powers that be on ending this embargo now. In fact, there's a lot of upside, not the least of which is that when that ET technology is brought out, the impact of that technology is almost incalculable. It will open up, primarily through enormous access to extremely cheap energy, a whole new renaissance of technological development, industry, money in the pockets of the big shots.
It'll generate jobs like unbelievable, and that'll be good for states and everyone else. And the other thing that it'll do, in my opinion, is it will create, in a very short order, capacity in our refineries, because we will no longer have to be making diesel fuel and gasoline. We can use the same refineries to produce the chemicals and polymers that we would need to fuel the other industries. It's a wonderful idea. You know, people think that, gosh, if we stop putting gasoline in our cars, it's going to cause economic collapse. Nothing could be further from the truth. Gasoline does not make anybody any money. It's the chemicals that come off of oil that make the money.
I'll defer to you on that, but again, and now we're getting into some of the things I'll be talking about at Michael Sala's conference in early May in Hawaii, and I certainly hope people come to this. I mean, there can't be a more beautiful setting for a conference in the world right now. I just think it's a tremendous opportunity. Tricky people in Hawaii, they don't take advantage of this. They're nuts. But I'll be talking about some of the issues here are almost infinite. The United States right now is probably being held in the lowest esteem since the turn of the last century, the early 1900s, the Spanish-American War. And if that ET technology were brought forward and we could show how it could be applied to the environmental problems that are facing the world's people, that the water shortages, which we could solve through cheap, efficient desalinization plants, and food issues, transport issues, electrogravitic anti-gravity systems would allow enormous change in how we can move goods and services. All of this we could bring to the world by bringing this tech out, and overnight we could go from being a pariah to being the great truth tellers, the great bringers of new tech, the ones that are going to save us from global warming. All of that is sitting right there in the underground facilities in the middle of this country right now, and is only being withheld because somebody hasn't solved the public relations equation to get it out and everybody save face. Well, you know, I think we no longer need to try to solve that equation. We just need to get it out and move forward. So this is just one of a list of benefits that come to us by ending this embargo, and I could go on and on. And part of our role now as upscale political activists is telling this message to the people so that they get the message too that, wait a minute, we want this out. We don't want this hidden any longer. We will change dramatically the subject and alter history in ways that could be very beneficial not only to the U.S. but to everyone else.
There's no question in my mind that people are going to say, "What? You mean that stuff was really real?" Michael, are there exopolitical ramifications for a movement like this in the United States?
Well, definitely, if people start to suspect what's really been happening, I think they'll start to mobilize. But I think too many people feel that the whole exopolitical issue isn't yet real enough for them. I mean, people are still sitting on the fence, and there's still the ridicule factor, and those are things that keep people away from this. But if we were to get, say, some of these larger public activist organizations like Move On to take this issue seriously, then I think we can really have a kind of mass mobilization happening to take the disclosure forward. But the question I wanted to raise to Steve is, does he think that the disclosure process will happen by deliberate design in terms of the cabal or the six committees that are making decisions, looking through the political process and working out how and when to release some information? Or does he think that disclosure will happen through some inadvertent disclosures, through some process associated, say, with the disintegration of the Bush administration?
Well, the answer is this, that I'm quite sure that those in the government who are in a management position on this issue have been planning for this event for some time. Not only have they been planning for it as a proactive event, they've also been planning a response if something were to trigger it. Understand that the ETs could have ended this embargo anytime they wanted to, and they could do it tomorrow. They got to park 25 saucers over Washington, D.C., end of embargo. And so since the government
exactly
does not control their actions, they have to be prepared, and I think they are, to respond to an external-generated event, as well as they have done their game-playing and their role-playing, which they love to do, on how to do this. So I don't anticipate they're going to be particularly caught by surprise. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with this. Look, I fully expect the government, when it finally takes action here, to operate in a way which makes them look good. They're going to serve their own interests. This is kind of the way the government works these days. So they're going to handle this in a way that makes them look as good as possible, it saves as much space as possible, and gives them as much of an edge. Now, it's up to the people to not allow them to hold sway on this in all regards. We need to put pressure on them to ensure that our needs are serviced and the truth overall is serviced on this, and that requires an involved and aware public. The disclosure process and the exopolitical movement is as much a matter of raising the awareness of tens of millions of people as it is driving the process itself. That awareness will come in handy in the aftermath, the days after the disclosure event takes place. And people are going to have to stand up and demand more from their government, and I hope that they will be motivated in that instant. But I'm perfectly prepared for the government to basically handle this in its own way and to try to serve its own interests, and we'll deal with that when the time comes. But I'm also not too worried that the government's ability to completely control this will evaporate pretty fast, because
sure it will.
The global intensity, once this issue breaks open, will be unprecedented in human history.
There's no doubt about it. And you know, we're doing it here on this program, although it's rather small. But, you know, it won't be long till the Oprahs and the Fox News and all of them will be in on it, too. It'll be global, and it'll be so fast and so rapid that, you know, the things that the Brookings Institute were worried about as far as people realizing that we're not alone in the universe will evaporate like fairy tales. People
oh, yeah.
are ready for this.
Look, we are very used to what we call the media feeding frenzy. We just had one. We have one going right now regarding the tragedy
at Virginia Tech.
So we've seen what the media does when it gets hold of an issue that has, quote, broad appeal. Let me tell you, when the disclosure event happens, what you will see following, you take the Monica Lewinsky case, you take the Virginia Tech, take every feeding frenzy, including, oh, let's throw in Anna Nicole Smith, take them all, put them together, multiply them by 10. Then you will have an idea of how massive, how comprehensive, how total the media frenzy on this issue will be. It will be global, it will be 24/7, and it will go on for months and months and months. In other words, we will finally cash in on this huge, multi-layered, multiplex media conglomerate that we've created, which is a little bit, it's too corporatized, it's in too few hands, but it is massive, it is huge, it includes satellites and dishes and uncounted reporters. We will finally get a payoff, because when they are let loose in the aftermath of the disclosure event, no government official, no secret program, no cabal will be able to withstand the onslaught that will come at them. And they will, I hope, yield to this and simply go into full truth mode and say, we're not going to fight this. What do you want? Here are the documents.
Uh-huh.
Here's the program. Here's what we knew. Here's what we knew then. Here's what we know now. Here are the deals that have been struck. okay, we did our best. We tried to serve the nation. It was national security. And then we will see what happens after that. There are no guarantees. The human race.
Well, I'm all for the feeding frenzy. I'm all for the press, you know, taking this and running with it, as long as it gets the start right here on X Squared Radio, because we're really paying. Hey,
you know,
come on, Matt Drudge made his name on the Monica Lewinsky disclosure. And X Squared Radio can make its name on the disclosure of real ETs here on the world.
Well, I have a list of every show that I've ever done since I got into this field in 1996. They're all cataloged, and I can assure you that if disclosure happens on Monday, I will be very partial to all of my friends in the media that have covered this issue and helped bring it forward, and I'll be taking their calls first.
That's right.
And let us all hope that all of us, not only the researchers, the activists, and the media people who have championed this issue at our own expense, sometimes at great personal cost for decades, will be able to participate in the post-disclosure milieu, that we will have our say, our voices will be heard, we will get some attention, and be able to provide perspective on this. The ridicule curtain will be down, the ghetto will be empty, and hopefully we will be treated with a reasonable degree of respect and consideration. That doesn't mean that every one of us somehow has the absolute truth, but we do have and have earned, I think, the right to try to influence the process of post-disclosure.
Yes, and, absolutely.
And I certainly will be an effort there.
We have a desire for the truth, and that is, I think, more than most of the outlets are going to give you, and that's what we're about here too. We want full disclosure. We have an open invitation. Here we seek after the best guests, and yes, you know, maybe they're the same guests that appear on some of the other programs, even the 800-pound gorilla in this genre. But we feel like we get the guest that gets to tell his story fully here, and we don't hold anything back. We go a little past people's imaginations, but it's okay, because that's what we do here. We want to get to the root of it and try to describe it as best we can.
Well, the technology of the Internet and podcasting and Internet broadcasting, this is all part and parcel of the pressure on the government.
Sure.
It's just impossible to withstand this technology unless they shut it all down in some sort of martial law, deal where they cannot withstand the pressure from this media. You're in the cutting edge. I predict in the post-disclosure world, your audiences will grow to very substantial numbers, as it should be. The conferences will expand. By the way, since I mentioned conferences, in addition to Michael Salas' conference in Hawaii in May, I think that's 11 to 14, I'm speaking in Montreal on the 8th at the International Institute of Human Integral Resources Conference, Sciences rather. That's May the 8th in Montreal. I'll also be speaking in Bordentown, New Jersey on the 28th of April, coming right up. And then I'll be in Roswell in July and at the Crash Retrieval Conference in November. And there's other conferences coming up.
There's the Bay Area UFO Conference in San Francisco. I'll be speaking there along with several of my friends. That is a big one. That's the granddaddy of all UFO conferences there.
It's an important conference. I know Mike will be speaking at a number of these conferences. So the venues are there. The media is there. We have the websites. We have the information and the research. And we have a developing movement. So we've done pretty well. But unfortunately, it's not good enough, because any reasonable assessment of the world situation right now is very dire. There are a number of areas where we're at political, environmental tipping points, where we may end up heading down an irreversible path that's going to cause enormous damage.
I agree.
We don't have a lot of time to, quote, gather ourselves together. We have got to press forward very quickly and get some serious changes and get into the truth business before we do something truly dumb that we can't get out from under or avoid the consequences from, that will put us out of action for decades, if not longer.
And we're trying to avoid conflict. We're trying to be politically, maybe not correct, but politically savvy, and we're not trying to be boisterous or braggadocious about this, but we are trying to be enlightening and awakening, and we're trying to get people to realize the power and the importance of this issue, because it goes well beyond just saying, okay, it's no longer science fiction, okay? There's a lot more to it than that. It has wonderful ramifications to the future of the human race.
Sure. And that is that will be the principal subject matter people will get into if they come to the Earth Transformation Conference in Hawaii, Kona, or the Montreal Conference. There's going to be a lot of that there. We're getting into most more post-disclosure presentations, post-disclosure thinking, meaning we're just putting ourselves on the other side of the paradigm shift and trying to talk about that, which is perfectly appropriate. But I can't lose sight of the fact that there's still a political movement underway and the disclosure has not taken place yet. I think one thing I'm very proud of, if you look at the entire movement, not only the citizen science movement going back to 47, but the political movement that emerged after 91, it has been completely nonviolent. There's been almost no civil disobedience at all.
Sure.
It has been generally self-funded. It has been consistent. It has done its best against tremendous resistance. I think I am very proud of this movement, the people in it. And while not everybody maybe gets everything right, I think they have nothing to be ashamed of. It has been an extraordinary effort. It needs to get more money. It needs to get more people involved. We need some Hollywood celebrities to join up. But this has been a movement that has nothing to be ashamed of. And if it succeeds, we'll have accomplished one of the greatest events in all of time, bringing about the ultimate rebirth, or not rebirth, but the ultimate birthing of this planet, where it goes from an isolated, non-self-disclosed species to a species which knows formally that it is part of a galaxy of life and civilizations. This is the prime moment in the history of this planet, going back to the first bacteria that pulled up in the eddies of the oceans several billion years ago. And we're here.
I agree with that. I hate to cut you off, but we are out of time, and I can't think of a better way to end it. That was a magnificent statement. Michael, I appreciate you being on the program. Stephen Bassett, I cannot wait to meet you at the conference in Hawaii. I wish you the best of luck. You're welcome back on this program anytime.
Thank you so much, Brooks. Michael, I'll see you in Kona. Mahalo.
Aloha, Steve.
Aloha,
and
both of you. All right, my friends, that's it for X Squared Radio tonight. And we appreciate you coming on live with us. Sorry we couldn't take your calls, but we'll make sure that this one goes in the free area of X Squared Radio so that you can access it. And I will play my exit. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio, saying, peace, Earth Explorers.